This is What's Left on WMBR in Cambridge, and I'm Linda.
And this is Sophia.
And we have two guests with us, one in the studio and one by phone. Nancy Murray is with... Oh, you're going to do the intros.
No, that's fine. Yeah, Nancy Murray. Yeah. She is one of the founders, and she's also the president of the board member of the GASA Mental Health Foundation. And we also have Omar Bader here, the executive director of the American Arab Anti-Discrimination Committee of Massachusetts, and he's also a steering committee member of the U.S. campaign to end the Israeli occupation.
So welcome, both of you, to What's Left.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Now that sounds like it's a little bit, Nancy, you sound like you're coming at us from a can.
A can?
Yeah. Sound
oh,
like
dear.
You're... Uh-oh. You don't have your radio on, do you?
No.
That sound quality's pretty bad. I think it's me. Hang on. They are now trying.
Is this better?
Yes, that's perfect. Thank you.
Okay, terrific.
So, where are we at? I mean, we've all heard the mainstream media representations of what's going on. The mainstream media has been focusing on the two sides of the problem, the fact that bombs are falling on parts of Israel and the fact that bombs are falling on Gaza. What's wrong with this picture that's being painted by the mainstream media in the United States? What are the things that you object to the most?
Omar, do you want to start or should I launch in?
I can go for it. So I think... There's the obvious thing, which is the issue of proportion. I mean, I think it would not be an exaggeration to say that what Gazans are seeing today is the worst thing that they have seen so far in the entire Israeli-Palestinian conflict in terms of the conditions they have been forced to live under. So you have, just over the past less than 2 weeks, over 700 people killed, half of whom are women and children, and over 3,000 wounded. I mean, this is... There, you know, that kind of pace and level of killing is something that we have not seen Israel do in a long time. But it's not about just proportions compared to less than a dozen Israelis who have been killed so far due to the conflict. It has to do with the equation that mainstream American media has presented so far. There has been a wholesale adoption of Israel's narrative of the conflict in that it is Hamas firing rockets and then Israel being forced to respond to those rockets. And yes, too bad Palestinians are suffering, but Hamas is to blame for firing those rockets and Israel just can't sit by and do nothing. When this is, I think, a very inaccurate representation of the equation that is actually taking place, I think a more accurate equation would say that it is Israel has been occupying the Gaza Strip for over 40 years now. In the last year and a half, they have imposed a devastating siege on the Gaza Strip that has caused skyrocketing malnutrition, over 250 deaths due to people not being able to access adequate medical care. You have continued settlement expansion in the West Bank. You have several violations of the ceasefire committed by Israel, and I think this is a very important point, is that the UN has documented over 7 Israeli violations of the ceasefire in a single week back in June before any Palestinian rockets were launched. And the message to Palestinians is either you passively accept this treatment, or if you dare respond in any kind of violence to this type of treatment, then this is going to justify mass Israeli slaughter. That's really the equation that Israel has put on the table for Palestinians. And essentially, as morally reprehensible and as strategically stupid the firing of rockets is, it really should be put in a context of Palestinians being essentially starved like rats in the Gaza Strip and out of desperation reacting in a way that is unwise. And to say that this actually justifies Israeli action is absolutely reprehensible, given everything that Israel has done, especially in the last 2 weeks.
Yes, I would agree with everything Omar said. And I would add that a member of the faculty of MIT recently wrote, this is Nancy Kanwisher, an incredibly good analysis of how these conflicts get broken in terms of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. She's analyzed over the period from 2000, the period of the Second Intifada, when there has been a truce, which side has broken it first? And she concludes, and there are elaborate tables included in this article in the Huffington Post, she concludes that in 79% of the cases, it is Israel that initiates the resumption of the conflict. Only 8% of the cases is it Palestinian attacks which caused the resumption, and the remaining both sides retaliated against each other on the same day. I mean, there's a real history here. This is nothing new. I remember going to Gaza in 2002, in July 22, 2002. Fatah and Hamas were about to announce a truce, a long-range truce to give Israel basically, you know, what it wanted in terms of relief from the suicide attacks, from rockets. And within an hour, they were supposed to announce it, before it could be announced, an hour before, Israel bombed the most densely populated part of Gaza City, presumably, it said, to kill a Hamas leader, and ended up killing 17 people in an apartment block, including 11 children. It doesn't want a long-term truce. I mean, I think that is the lesson of this history. It wants to be able to exonerate its actions, to continually bludgeon the Palestinian people. We have seen this over time. It is not just this 10 days. This has been going on, you know, steadily since the occupation began and even before. Gaza has 70% of its population are refugees, and they are refugees who were expelled from Israel when it was created. In fact, they were expelled from the Ashkelon area, which has now been reached by these rockets in 1948. I mean, there's a very long history here. So to just take a snapshot of these last 10 days and not put it in this long context doesn't really give you the full picture.
Well, let's go back just a little ways to the recent ceasefire, because the media coverage of that has been confusing to me. It was a six-month ceasefire, and then apparently the U.S. government encouraged Israel not to renew the ceasefire. Is that right?
Well, what I understand happened, and I don't know the facts, but piecing them together, what I have read, it seems over this 6 months, Israel was preparing this invasion. It was preparing the propaganda war, which would accompany the hot war. And it, you know, as Omar said, it was killing Palestinians throughout the so-called ceasefire. And then on November 4th, it made an incursion into Gaza that killed six Palestinians. Allegedly, it was looking for, it was saying that it was going after the tunnels because it thought the Palestinians were going to use these tunnels to kidnap a soldier. But that was the real massive unraveling. And I think what happened was they were prepared. They had done the work of preparing the public for what had to come, which was this massive military strike. They had their, you know, propaganda ducks in order, and they were ready to go. So in that sense, you know, one could think, well, what is the end game really all about? Is it to restore Fatah, which, as we know, the CIA tried to do after the democratic elections of January 2006, or is there another agenda here? And my own real fear is that the agenda is not to restore Hamas. Not to restore Fatah, to keep Fatah where it is in the West Bank and to allow Hamas in a very humbled form, a reduced Hamas to be there in the Gaza Strip, which will be a totally closed prison with the tunnels destroyed, with no possibility of rebuilding, a continuation of the 18-month period of siege, absolute siege, which preceded these bombings. By that time, you know, the headlines will no longer be talking about Gaza. In fact, no one will be thinking about it. And the future might be, unless we really intercede now to make sure this doesn't happen, that the 1.5 million people of the Gaza Strip, over half of whom are children, will be just left in this ruined landscape without sufficient food, water, medical supplies, raw materials to linger.
That's one of the things that I wanted to ask, is I think there are two myths in my mind that have been perpetuated by the media. which is, you know, Israel says that they pulled all the settlers from Gaza and gave Gaza to the Hamas government. And that also added to, now they're saying, well, there's no humanitarian crisis in Gaza. I don't know what people are talking about.
And, yes, exactly. Omar, do you want to have a stab at what happened after 2005?
Yeah, essentially, the Gaza Strip was, after the election of Hamas is when things really went downhill big time. I don't think, I'm not sure if Israel was expecting that or not, but the Gaza Strip has been put under siege. Money that was tax money that was collected from the Palestinian population was now withheld and refused to give in to the Palestinian Authority until Hamas met certain conditions that were never demanded of Israel, you know, including recognizing the other side, you know, ceasing to use violence, and all sorts of stuff that Israel never abided by to begin with.
Mm-hmm. But let's just go back a little few months earlier, because once the settlers were withdrawn in the summer of 2005, Hamas wasn't in power. It was Fatah in power. Mm-hmm. And what happened was, no sooner were the settlers withdrawn than the gates were locked. You know, the warders left the jail but locked the inmates in, and they started this horrific and barbaric several weeks of sonic booms. With their air force, just swooping in. And this is why there are so many kids in Gaza who are deaf. These sonic booms, it was a pattern of total intimidation that they couldn't do when their settlers were in place. And, you know, basically they have had the Gaza Strip as a laboratory to experiment. How do you cause a people to buckle under and cry uncle? What will it take? And it's almost like it's a lab, and they have been trying out all these techniques. Now, recently, we've heard not just from the F-16 bombings, the Apaches, the tank fire, but we've heard of phosphorus weapons being used to burn people. We've heard of cluster bombs. We've heard of bunker buster bombs, which have been used. This is a tiny area. It's not much bigger than Boston. It's a small area where no one has any place to hide. It's 22 miles long and 3 miles wide.
But and there's 6 million people there, right? Is that correct?
No, it's 1.5 million.
1.5 million, okay.
Most of them refugees and most of them children. And, you know, to sort of, you know, to take the world's fourth largest army and simply unleash it on this people. While the world stands by, I won't say silently, because here in Boston, for instance, there have been at least 10 demonstrations that I know of, and about 8 I've participated in. And let me just tell your listeners, there will be another funeral procession this Saturday leaving from Copley at noon, wear black. We're going to have coffins and basically have a silent procession through the streets of Boston. So, you know, the protest from the level of the street is going on everywhere, but that hasn't stopped anything, as you know.
Yeah. To follow up on an earlier point that Nancy made about the war being planned in advance, indeed, there is a Haaretz article that was issued recently in which Israeli defense officials were quoted as saying that the planning for this war had taken place 6 months in advance. And I think that a few things can be gathered about why this has taken place, especially at this time. There is the domestic Israeli politics aspect of it, where Netanyahu, the right-wing forces, were actually, you know, making significant gains in the polls. And as a way of cutting into that, they decided that shortly before the elections, which are taking place next month, it would be a good time for the current government to unleash its military might against the people of Gaza as a way of cutting into Netanyahu's lead. A second aspect of it, which, again, a White House official was quoted in the Washington Post as saying, Israel was not certain how Obama is going to react to the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, and so they felt that it was important to get all the things that they wanted to get done before Obama came into office. In case Obama pressures Israel into negotiations, then they would be in a much more powerful position, having just devastated Hamas in the Gaza Strip, and in the hopes that they would get better terms on such negotiations. And I think the coverage on Jon Stewart just a couple of nights ago on this has been absolutely amazing. For those who haven't had a chance to catch it, you really should look that up online. And I think the third aspect is trying to regain some the image of the Israeli military after its relative defeat on the hands of Hezbollah 2 years ago. So now you have a substantially weaker force. Hamas is substantially weaker than Hezbollah. You have the Gaza Strip that has been completely isolated and starved for a couple of years now, as compared to Lebanon, which has very difficult topography with open borders with Syria that allows for humanitarian aid to come in and the flow of weapons and so on. So they felt that they had a much better chance here at restoring some level of Israeli military credibility.
Right. And I would just add, in what Omar said about it being starved before this invasion, my last trip there was in late October of this year, or last year, 2008. I was supposed to take part in a conference, an end-the-siege conference. They had invited international presenters, largely medical workers, mental health workers, and academics to come and look at the impact of this 18-month-old siege on the people of Gaza. And the World Health Organization tried to arrange permits. They tried for 2 months. We all arrived at Erez Crossing and the edge of Gaza, and we were not allowed in, so we ended up demonstrating there and then having a video hookup conference from the West Bank. And what we heard was so frightening. It's not just that medicines were kept out, access to medical supplies. Food was calibrated. You know, how much can we reduce a population but not allow mass starvation, because that won't look very good. But by December 14th, the Sunday Times of London had a headline, "People in Gaza reduced to eating grass." They weren't dying, you know, like in a natural disaster, but the statistics about malnourishment, about anemia in children, stunted children, this, you know, has an incredible significance for the future. And if you add to that this intense bombardment these people have had to endure and the trauma, which was already, according to studies of the Gaza Community Mental Health Program, which my foundation supports, was already at 90% of the population before this. You know, you just wonder, what does Israel think? Is its intention simply to kill everyone off? If not, has it thought about what it will mean to have these people as neighbors, who it has reduced in this horrible way to totally traumatized, starved, and demonized, I would say, non-humans. When Livni, foreign minister of Israel, said the other day, just a few days ago, there is no humanitarian crisis in Gaza, what she was really saying is there are no human beings in Gaza. I mean, this was a classic instance of the racism,
you know,
with
I had
which
a,
people are regarded.
I had a couple other questions because I want to talk about some of the myths, you know, that are being talked in the media, in mainstream media. One of the things was the way that the media uses militants every time they talk about, you know, the
right.
The killing of militants, and then,
exactly.
You know, one thing that caught my ear was that one of the first bombs fell on the police headquarters of Gaza, and I was, and then they said the militants, you know, and so many militants
right.
died.
These were cadets.
And then the other thing was also about how, you know, the Israeli officials are saying that they are throwing leaflets on Gaza, saying asking people in Gaza to leave.
Mm-hmm.
So they can avoid the bombing. Why don't we get this question to Omar first?
Okay.
It has been indeed absolutely ridiculous to see the propaganda techniques that have been used by Israel recently. In addition to the things that you have just mentioned, there's also the new announcement that came out either today or yesterday that they're going to be halting the operations for 3 hours a day to allow for some humanitarian aid to get into the Gaza Strip and then resume the bombing. I mean, just think of the idea of bombing indiscriminately throughout civilian areas, causing hundreds of deaths, and then saying, let's pause and give people some food. It's just absolutely absurd. And on the question of getting out of the way, the Gaza Strip is the single most densely populated area in the entire world. To have 1.5 million people in a place that small. And given the fact that Israel has secured Egyptian cooperation, there is nowhere for Gazans to go. That's just a fact. So dropping of leaflets is obviously a propaganda technique so they can say that they are trying to avoid civilian casualties, when in reality it has absolutely no effect. And on the police, the bombing of the police station that you mentioned, it's also worth mentioning that there was a graduation ceremony there for new police officers, and scores of them had been killed. Now, I think in talking about the siege and getting Egyptian cooperation, this might be worth noting the role of regional actors in this process. So you constantly hear about moderate Arab regimes in the region who want to have peace with Israel. And I think it's important to note here that the term moderate is really just euphemism for within the Israel, within the U.S. orbit, countries that are, you know, interested in having, you know, are satisfied with U.S. dominance in the region and have that alliance. And
what are those countries?
Countries like Jordan, like Egypt, like Saudi Arabia. And they're anything but moderate. I mean, these are very dictatorial regimes under which there is corruption is rampant, torture takes place all the time. And by contrast, the countries that are immoderate, countries like Syria and groups like Hamas, I mean, the only significant difference between such parties is that the ones that are labeled immoderate or extreme are the ones who are conditioning a full compliance of Israel with international law before they agree to have any kind of talks with Israel or a peace settlement. So we have this myth that Hamas rejects out of hand ever recognizing Israel, when in fact Jimmy Carter had just come back from the region a few months ago with a pledge that Hamas was willing to recognize Israel in return for a full end to the Israeli illegal occupation of the occupied territories. And Khaled Mishaal, the head of Hamas, has also been quoted saying that, you know, in an English television interview with Al Jazeera. So unlike the PLO, unlike Fatah and what they have learned from the Oslo process, where recognition of Israel came as the first step, and the hope is that then Israel would comply with international law, what we saw was the exact opposite. Israel systematically undermined the two-state solution by building more and more illegal Israeli settlements throughout the occupied territories and making the lives of Palestinians more and more difficult. So Hamas is saying, we've given this a try, now you have to end the occupation first, and then we're going to recognize you, and then we can have a peace deal that is based on full, comprehensive Israeli compliance with international law. So I think that's just a point worth noting when we talk about moderate regimes. There's nothing moderate about such regimes, apart from the fact that they're willing to take orders from the United States.
And let me just add about the militants. According to the Save the Children UK statistics, as of yesterday, there are 101 children who have died in this conflict.
Mm-hmm. Well, we're speaking with Nancy Murray, who is the president of the Gaza Mental Health Foundation, and Omar Badar, who is executive director of the American Arab Anti-Discrimination Committee. Where do we go from here? I mean, what can we as U.S. citizens do to try to get our government to intervene? Is that our most useful role?
That's the thing, is I think it's important to note that the U.S. government has been intervening. It has been intervening at least ever since 1967 very heavily in unrestrained support for one side in the conflict, the Israeli side. It does that through massive military aid. You know, this decade we're going to be spending $30 billion in military aid to Israel, and Israel would not be able to carry out all of the attacks that it does without this U.S. weaponry. And then you have the diplomatic support. The United States has blocked over 42 U.N. resolutions that have been critical of Israel since the 1970s, which is greater than the number of all vetoes cast by all other members of the Security Council, permanent members, combined on all issues. So that really puts things into perspective. And when we talk about the U.S. role in this particular conflict, pressuring Egypt to close the border, and now we know that there are American soldiers on the ground in Egypt to make sure that nothing is being smuggled in across the border, and they have blocked a U.N. resolution that would have called for an immediate ceasefire. So the U.S. role has been very unproductive. It's not a matter of U.S. intervention. It's a matter of U.S. fair intervention, and that is something that we definitely have to demand, especially with the new administration coming in, which we're not quite sure how they're going to react to the situation.
And I would like to encourage everyone in Massachusetts to contact Senator Kerry, because he will be the chair of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee.
God help us.
So, yeah, I know. But anyway, let me give his telephone number, 202-224-2742. You know, the way they are using U.S. weapons against civilians, it's not only a war crime, it's against many U.S. laws. It's against the U.S. Arms Export Control Act. It's against the U.S. Foreign Assistance Act. So when people contact Senator Kerry, I think they have to say, cut off U.S. military aid to Israel. That is what the law requires. When you use these weapons the way Israel is using them, you get cut off. And it's, you know, time we really, in one voice, in the people of conscience, really let our congressmen know. I know many people, when I ask them to contact Congress, they say, oh, no, I mean, what a waste of time. But, you know, we have to keep trying. I think we just have to make ourselves stronger and more persistent and keep trying.
Okay. Well, thank you both so much for being here. I don't know if you want to add anything else, Omar? No? Okay, good. Thank you both for being with us today.
Thank you very much for having
us.
And
next time we'll have Omar debating Alan Dershowitz.
No, we will not have Alan Dershowitz on the program ever, because I'm not allowed to say curse words on the radio. So it wouldn't be possible. And because this, after all, is What's Left on WMBR Cambridge.
عايشين ورا سجون البنود اللي سجنين لنا ما يتغير مش حاسين ولا نور الا سياج منها احنا شايفين سما لونها ازرق غير ما ابيض بالنص جمال زكراك انت بغير بس لا انا صامد عايش متفائل ما تعزل مني الامل بيجي دار فاصل بالسور يدور انا مربوط فلسطين كجنين لحبل الطابور بالارض يدور شجر زيتون ضل يتولد وجدد وجدد خصور غصن ممدود للسلام معروض الاحتلال ما يريد استسلام ليه انا اللي ما اله حريه لاني انا رافض اني اعيش بعبوديه